Good evening, everyone. Here comes some more faces. So good to see you all. I hope that this is feeling a little bit like Sesshin in certain ways for you, even though it's not what we usually think of as Sesshin. Now, you might think that this Sesshin theme was going to be all about gardening, growing flowers and vegetables in our backyards, community gardens, and patios. But Wednesday evening, I talked about Zen gardens with the intent to encourage you to find the heart of the Zen garden in your ordinary daily life. Did any of you find a little Zen garden in some corner, some unexpected corner? I hope so. It might be the way stones and seaweed are strewn on a beach, or the way an eagle soars above the city, or the way your shoulders relax as you walk or sit in a grove of old-growth red cedars. And last night, Michael shared with us, some of the Dharma of trees. And when he told us about the ancient tradition of marking trees as sacred beings, and how, in one sense, it was revived in Thailand by ordaining threatened trees, forest trees, to protect them, and how even right now in Massachusetts, our friend Kanshin Ruth Ozeki has been ordaining a stand of ornamental cherry trees to protect them from destruction. And it made me think, oh, well, maybe we should go out to Fairy Creek and start ordaining some red cedars and Douglas firs, marking them as our elders, marking them as sacred, our teachers. I wonder what a rakasu for a red cedar would look like. Any fabric artists out there who want to try making one, let me know. So this feels like a good segue into my topic for this evening, which I'm calling Tending the Wild. Now, tending the wild might seem like an oxymoron, according to the conventional way of thinking that labels the wild as untouched by human hands or tools, untrammeled by human feet. But really, this is a myth created by and reinforced by Western cultural values that have shaped the conservation movement that created national parks and wilderness areas as spaces protected from human intervention and interference. I mean, certainly that is necessary because we can certainly intervene and interfere in really harmful ways. But in time, it seems our national parks have become theme parks for drive-by tourists. And wilderness preserves have become enclaves hemmed in by development that cuts off the movement of species that's needed for genetic diversity and survival. And so we're needing to look beyond those strict definitions of what's wilderness and what's cultivated, what's civilized, and what's domesticated. Not so clear-cut, after all. How do we discern our responsibility to tend the wild if we're not even sure where or what it is. The term more than human, the more than human world, is maybe more encompassing and accurate than wild. This phrase, more than human, the more than human world, was coined over 25 years ago by the ecologist and philosopher David Abram in his book, The Spell of the Sensuous, Perception and Language in the More Than Human World. Anybody know that book? Highly recommended. It's on the reading list for this session. On its way to becoming a classic. And this phrase, the more than human world, I've noticed has come to be used more and more often by people discussing the complexity of the relationships between that world and the human world with more nuance and depth. It's become clear that there is no place on this earth that has not been touched by human activity. There is no pure wilderness. Sad to say, from the deepest ocean trenches to the highest mountains, to the most remote forest and coldest expanses of snow and ice, there is evidence of our toxic waste. Even the space surrounding our Earth is littered with dead satellites and other junk. I think the best Dharma text on this subject is not from the Buddhist canon, but from the American poet Gary Snyder's essay collection, The Practice of the Wild. Many of you I know must be familiar with it already. It's been over 30 years since it was published. But again, I think it can be considered a modern classic, and it's required Zen reading as far as I'm concerned. Gary Snyder cautions us not to think of the wild as something separate from us. And I've read this passage before, so if it sounds familiar to some of you, that's okay, because it bears repeating, just like passages from Dogen. He says, "Our bodies are wild. The involuntary quick turn of the head at a shout, the vertigo at looking off a precipice, the heart in the throat in a moment of danger, the catch of the breath, the quiet moments, relaxing, staring, reflecting, all universal responses of the mammal body, our bodies. The body does not require the intercession of some conscious intellect to make it breathe, to keep the heart beating. It is, to a great extent, self-regulating. It has a life of its own." We like to think, you know, we can micromanage our body. But it has a life of its own. Sensation and perception do not exactly come from outside, and the unremitting thought and image flow are not exactly inside. The world is our consciousness, and it surrounds us. There are more things in mind, in the imagination, than you can keep track of. Thoughts, memories, images, angers, delights rise unbidden. You may have noticed that any time you've been sitting in sesshin, right? As Gary Snyder did. The depths of mind, the unconscious, are our inner wilderness areas. And that is where a bobcat is, right now. I do not mean personal bobcats in personal psyches, but the bobcat that roams from dream to dream. The conscious, agenda-planning ego occupies a very tiny territory, a little cubicle somewhere near the gate, keeping track of some of what goes in and out. And the rest takes care of itself. The body is, so to speak, in the mind. They are both wild. I just love that passage. especially the bobcat, since Michael and I have each seen a bobcat right out in our backyard. And looking straight into the eyes of a bobcat is a kind of stopping moment. It's just a majestic animal. The embodiment of something wild. If we fear and avoid what we label as wild, we are likely to fear and avoid our own body and mind. I think our practice gives us the capacity to be present with our inner wildness. Particularly during Sesshin, when we make the commitment to stay put, no escape, and pay attention to what arises in our experience from moment to moment, without grabbing on, without pushing away. The kind of open curiosity. How does this body-mind work? This creature that is you. What can you learn from observing and experiencing, not just thinking and analyzing? I'm going to read you just a little bit more. Wait. No, not yet. I'm keeping going. Those of you who are here Monday night for my talk on soil may remember that I mentioned how in the Judeo-Christian tradition, God is said to have put plants and animals on earth for us humans, and to have given us dominion over them. Whereas many indigenous traditions consider humans to be the youngest, least experienced of the world's creatures, and the plants and animals to be our teachers who show us how to live in this world. Stories from indigenous traditions tell us how spiders taught us weaving, and mud wasps taught us how to make pottery. Paper wasps showed the ancient Chinese how to make paper by pulping plant fiber. Have you ever looked at a paper, look closely at a paper wasp, if a paper wasp nest falls, and you can look at the paper and the beautiful layers and colors, incredible, depending on where they've sourced their plant fibers. Beavers showed us how to make dams. But theirs are much more biodegradable than ours. And their dams have a life cycle that promotes biodiversity and enriches ecosystems rather than destroying them like our dams do. Did you know there's movement to decommission dams? There's a lot of dams all across this continent that are reaching the end of their life cycle. And they need to be taken down and the rivers freed. There are people working on that. The birds and mammals showed us which plants can harm and which can heal by the ways they use them. Though I wouldn't go out and take those observations as entirely reliable, because squirrels can eat very poisonous mushrooms that we can that would make us very, very sick, or might even kill us. So, learning from animals is also a matter of a bit of trial and error, I think. But learning from animals is not just a thing of the past. Here's a modern example. When the fastest train in the world, the Japanese bullet train, was first designed, there was a problem with the noise it made emerging from a tunnel. The sudden change in air pressure would make a loud thunderclap. And it was really disturbing to the people in the vicinity who complained. So the train's chief engineer, who happened to be a devoted bird watcher, asked himself, is there some living thing that manages sudden changes in material densities as a part of its daily life. And he thought of the kingfisher, which is a bird that dives from sometimes pretty quite high up at quite a speed into the water, into a lake or a river, to catch fish. And the kingfisher has a long, tapered beak. When it dives, it makes hardly a splash. So he redesigned the bullet train's front end according to the design of a kingfisher's beak. And not only was it quieter, but it used 15% less electricity even when it traveled 10% faster. So back to Gary Snyder. He describes this way of learning from the wild through walking in the wild with our senses open and alert. He says, the world is as sharp as the edge of a knife. That's a Northwest Coast saying. I think it comes from the Haida people. Now, how does it look from the standpoint of peoples for whom there is no great dichotomy between their culture and nature? Those who live in societies whose economies draw on uncultivated systems. The pathless world of wild nature is a surpassing school, and those who have lived through her can be tough and funny teachers. Out here, one is in constant engagement with countless plants and animals. To be well educated is to have learned the songs, proverbs, stories, sayings, myths, and technologies that come with this experiencing of the non-human members of the local ecological community. Practice in the field, open country, is foremost. Walking is the great adventure and the first meditation, a practice of heartiness and soul primary to humankind. Walking is the exact balance of spirit and humility. There's an extraordinary teaching of specific plants and animals and their uses, empirical and impeccable, that never reduces them to objects and commodities. I love that description of walking. The first meditation, balance of spirit and humility. But plants and animals have been evolving in complex interdependent relationships since life began, long before we showed up, we humans. And it's not just a matter of ruthless competition, but a complex balancing act of mutual interdependency. And animals have actually been domesticating each other since long before humans and dogs forged their relationship. Symbiosis is ancient. From the humble lichen. Oh. Let me see if I can get this right. There's a sentence here I didn't complete. The humble lichen is a working relationship between a fungi and somebody help me. Who's a good botanist out there? Raise your hand. Todd, you know this. Yeah.
Algae.
The algae. Thank you. Had a little brain lapse. A fungi and an algae. Thank you. But lichen are amazing. Amazing creations. And then in the insect world, you know we don't have to look any further than ants and aphids. Probably you all know this, but just in case there's someone out there who doesn't, some species of ants could be called the Earth's first farmers because they maintain herds of aphids. Here's a description from McGill University's Office for Science and Society website. Aphids feed primarily on the sap from plants and secrete a liquid called honeydew. This secretion is very sugar-rich and quite favored by ants as a food source. not only as a food source for themselves, but they feed their larvae because this rich, very rich source of sugars. As a result, a system has been hashed out by these insects wherein the ants herd the aphids around to the juiciest parts of plants, protect them from predators, and carry them into their nests at night and for the winter. In return, the ants are allowed to milk the aphids by stroking the aphids with their antennae, coaxing them to secrete their honeydew, which is then lapped up by the ant, and then they take it back to their larvae. In every species of ants, workers will specialize in different roles, such as nursing the larvae or foraging to fulfill the needs of the colony. In farming ants, some workers specialize just in herding, shepherding, and caring for the aphids. Now, how amazing is that? There's even evidence that some ants build pastures of a sort to keep their herded aphids in. When the colony departs one nest site to form another at a new location, they will carry aphid eggs with them to establish a new herd and maintain their resources. Okay, there was another piece of ant lore I was going to tell you, but I think I might not have time. Oh, now you want to hear it. Okay, so if that isn't amazing enough, there's another species of ant in the rainforest of New Guinea that has domesticated a kind of scale insect that has lost its legs in the process and is totally dependent on the ant herders to move it from place to place inside a tree because the tree bark is too tough. So the ants move these little scale insects around inside the tree where they can suck the sap. And the ants milk the scale insects just like of their honeydew, just like aphids. And then they move them around because the tree starts to harden around the little cavities. So they move them further out on the branches. And in exchange, they keep the tree, as they go up and down the tree, the ants keep the vines and parasitic plants that would slow down its growth. So they take care of the tree too. They don't just drain the tree of sap. So it's a three-way symbiotic relationship. Ha! So in this same way of co-evolution, indigenous peoples have been tending the wild since human culture began, passing on practices through millennia, learning through detailed observation of the beings in their environment, how to cultivate right relationship, mutually beneficial relationship, and passing that knowledge down through the generations. It's kind of an American myth that this continent was somehow pristine and untouched by humans before white colonists arrived. Indigenous people had already been practicing agriculture and managing the more than human environment for thousands of years through controlled burning, selective harvesting, and complementary planting. Maybe you've heard of the sacred triad, the three sisters of corn, beans, and squash. The corn provides the support for the bean vines. The beans are a legume with nodules of nitrogen-fixing bacteria on the roots, so they provide nourishment, and the squash vines provide ground cover to protect the soil from the hot sun. Robin Wall Kimmerer tells stories of these interactions in the book that I mentioned earlier, Braiding Sweetgrass, Indigenous Wisdom, Scientific Knowledge, and the Teachings of Plants. Also required reading on your session reading list. I found it fascinating that to learn that sweetgrass, from the title of her book, sweetgrass is a grass with long satiny leaves, and it's sacred to many First Nations people, used for ceremonial smudging, basket weaving, and medicinal purposes. Often it's braided, it's twisted into braids and given as a gift. Kimmerer emphasizes the practices of gratitude, respect, and reciprocity of gift giving and receiving in these relationships with the more than human world. She points out that in gift exchanging cultures, economies are self-renewing, that gratitude and reciprocity go together. She tells the story of how she went harvesting sweetgrass with an Anishinaabe elder named Lena. When they came to a patch of sweetgrass, Lena greeted it, then took out a small pouch of tobacco and sprinkled some on the ground, saying, "You know, it's rude not to ask first if you can take some and to leave a gift, and not to leave a gift in return." And then Lena showed her the way to pinch off the grass stems at the base without disturbing the roots, and to take no more than half what was there. And then Robin remembered that she'd been out harvesting with other families, and they too made offerings and took only half, but they would pull up a little clump of grass along with the roots, leaving a little bare patch. She pointed this out to Lena, who just gave a shrug. Now, Kimmerer is a botanist and a professor, so when some indigenous basket makers expressed concern that the sweetgrass was disappearing from its historic habitats, they asked her if the methods of harvesting were the cause. So she decided to help. She guided one of her graduate students to conduct a controlled experiment using these two different methods of harvesting. To their surprise, there was no significant difference between the two methods, and both patches did better than the control patch that was not harvested at all. So this suggested that the decline in sweetgrass could not be because of too much or too poor methods of harvesting, but rather lack of harvesting, lack of maintaining that relationship. The relationship was what was in decline. She did a similar experiment with declining stands of black ash trees used for traditional split ash baskets by the Potawatomi people, the people of her own father's ancestry. Same results. The carefully harvested stands were healthier than those left unused. So where's the wild? And where's the domesticated there? Kimmerer gives us a summary of guidelines for what she calls the honorable harvest. I'm just going to read these to you. Know the ways of the ones who take care of you so that you may take care of them. Introduce yourself. Be accountable as the one who comes asking for life. Ask permission before taking. Abide by the answer. I guess you have to say also, listen for the answer and then abide by it. Never take the first, never take the last. Take only what you need. Take only that which is given. Never take more than half, leave some for others. Harvest in a way that minimizes harm. Use it respectfully. Never waste what you have taken. Share. Give thanks for what you have been given. Give a gift in reciprocity for what you have taken. Sustain the ones who sustain you, and the earth will last forever. Can you imagine if our society adopted and abided by these guidelines? Can you imagine? Now, I don't think Kimmerer is recommending that we all go back to being hunter-gatherers. And neither am I. We'd probably make a disaster of it. But certainly we can adopt these principles, the principles and practices of gratitude, respect, and reciprocity, and apply them in our daily lives. We can certainly take more responsibility for living more lightly and harmoniously with the more than human world, upon which our own lives and well-being totally depend. We can look to other examples of sustainable agriculture and forestry and small-scale technologies that do not dominate and destroy, but harmonize with local ecosystems. In Japan, there's a concept and a movement called Satoyama. Sato means village or hamlet, and yama means mountain. I'm just going to read you a little description of it. Satoyama describes a rural Japanese landscape made up mainly of managed woodlands and grasslands, rice fields, and the network of waterways and reservoirs associated with them. Underlying those elements, however, Satoyama refers to certain principles of living on the land that belong no more to Japan than to any place long and sustainably cultivated by humans. Satoyama is land modified but not oversimplified, used but not monopolized. It is an ecosystem biodiverse by virtue of custom and culture, which predates environmentalism, wise stewardship born out of necessity more than ideology. It is characterized by a variety of uses, by the value of routine care, restraint, and community scale management, by interconnection and complexity, by much, in other words, that is antithetic to short-term monetary profit and short-sightedly efficient modern agriculture. Yet it is perhaps that very inefficiency that opens up the space for human use and biodiversity to coexist within the Satoyama landscape. For human use and biodiversity to coexist. One way we can manifest a reciprocal relationship with the more-than-human world is to make reparation for the harm that we humans have done. Restoration ecology is still a new science, and not all its practitioners agree on strategies and methods. Out on the fringe are the people who want to get DNA from long-frozen mammoths in Siberia and resurrect mammoths. And much as I would love to see a mammoth, I think our first devotion must be to the creatures that are still living. And it's tough, you know, reintroducing wolves. I was just looking at a website about, you know, how reintroducing wolves, Canadian timber wolves, to states like Wisconsin has reduced, because the wolves keep the deer population in check, has reduced car crashes with deer by something like 20%. But now, of course, the deer hunters are getting concerned because the wolves are taking more deer than they are. So it's complicated. It's easy to make mistakes when working with systems of such complexity that we don't fully understand them. The American poet W.S. Merwin and his wife bought an exhausted pineapple plantation in Hawaii and slowly and painstakingly created a forest garden of many species of palm tree. Merwin reflected in an essay about that effort, saying the model for this garden has always been the forest itself, even though I know that the word reforestation is generally meaningless, and that only a forest knows how to grow a forest. In her book, Robin Kimmerer tells the story of a man named Franz Dolp, who in his mid-50s, after a failed marriage and a failed farm, bought 40 acres of clear-cut land in Oregon and tried to restore the forest. He called it was like an old-growth nursery. He tried to restore an old-growth forest. He kept a journal, And he wrote, "My work grew out of a deeply experienced sense of loss, the loss of what should be here. These 40 acres were to be my retreat, my escape to the escape from the world. But this was no pristine wilderness. I realized that making a new home required more than building a cabin or planting an apple tree. It required some healing for me and for the land. My goal was to plant an old-growth forest. The unknowns pervading my work were as pervasive as shade in the forest." So he studied and planted and studied and planted, and he made lots of mistakes. He thought red cedars would do well along the moist stream banks, which is true, that's where red cedars like to live. But beavers devoured his seedlings. So he tried to think like a forest, and he tried again planting willows as kind of decoys to distract the beavers, and this time the cedars survived. He wrote, "I definitely should have met with a council of mice, bobcats, porcupines, beaver, and deer before I started this experiment." And after he completed his planting, he had planted all four of the 40 acres, he wrote, "I may heal the land, yet I have little doubt of the direction what the real benefits flow, that the real benefits flow. An element of reciprocity is the rule here. What I give, I receive in return. I have been engaged less in a personal forestry of restoration than in a forestry of personal restoration. In restoring the land, I restore myself." So it goes without saying, but I'm going to say it anyway. In restoring the earth, we restore ourselves. Now, I haven't said that much about what Buddhism teaches about the more than human world, but it's implicit, isn't it, in the teachings of impermanence and no separate self that tell us that we only exist in a dynamic matrix of interrelationship with all beings. Repeatedly, the Zen teachings tell us that the mountains, waters, and the great earth and all her creatures are none other than our own body and mind. I think maybe this truth is best expressed in the Avatamsaka Sutra as Indra's net. I'm sure most of you know that description, the ultimate ecosystem, a vast net of interrelationships stretching infinitely in all directions throughout space and time. At each node of the net is a jewel reflecting all the rest, so that everything we do of benefit or every way we restrain from harm makes a difference, extending far beyond what we can ever know. So I would like to close with a passage from the Avatamsaka Sutra. And if we were all together in one place, I would pass out copies and have us read this together. So imagine that all our voices are joined in this. In what manner should one accommodate and serve sentient beings? To do so, one should think. Throughout the realm of dharmas and the realm of space, in the ocean-like cosmos, in the 10 directions, there are infinite kinds of sentient beings. Some are born of eggs, some are born of the womb, of wetness, of metamorphosis. Some live by earth, some by water, fire, wind, space, trees, or flowers. Oh, countless are their kinds, and infinite are their forms, shapes, bodies, faces, lifespans, races, names, dispositions, views, knowledge, desires, inclinations, manners, costumes, and diets. They abide in numerous kinds of dwellings, in towns, villages, cities, and palaces. They comprise the devas, the nagas, the heavenly musicians, the tree nymphs, humans, non-humans, beings without feet, beings with two, four, or many feet. Some are with form, some are without form, some with or without thoughts, or neither with nor without thoughts. To all these infinite kinds of beings, I will render my service and accommodate them in whatever way is beneficial to them. Why should we cherish all sentient beings? Because sentient beings are the roots of the tree of awakening. The bodhisattvas and the Buddhas are the flowers and fruits. Compassion is the water for the roots. So I thank you once again for your kind attention. I just thought that's kind of like a little lullaby to send you off to sleep. I'm going to say that last verse again. Why should we cherish all sentient beings? Because sentient beings are the roots of the tree of awakening. The bodhisattvas and the Buddhas are the flowers and fruits. Compassion is the water for the roots. So, good night, everyone. Let's chant together.